This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Great to have you along this afternoon. This hour, the Australian Veterinary Association is calling on the federal government for more funding to help vets support the nation's future biosecurity responses as the threat of pests and disease continues to increase. Also today, the latest Australian Egg Sustainability Report is just out, and it's showing that the cost of living crisis has consumers placing equal, if not more, emphasis on the price of eggs rather than the production system, rather than whether they're free range or caged. We'll have a good look at that survey and the results just before the news headlines at 12:30 today. 12:06 here on the Country Hour on the ABC, right across Western Australia, streaming live on the web and on the ABC Listen app. First today, a range of organisations have fronted a Firearms Act inquiry in Perth this morning, highlighting a range of problems associated with the state's tough new gun laws. The WA government spent more than 2 years making changes to the legislation, which is currently going through a phase-in period. Now, the aim was to make WA's laws the toughest in the country, making it harder for people to get a firearms licence and also requiring stronger evidence for the need of a licence in the first place. But the rollout hasn't been smooth, and that's why this Firearms Act inquiry is underway. Richard Hudson has been following the proceedings. Richard, what range of issues have been raised?
Yeah, all sorts, and that's probably going to be the case, that a lot of different issues are going to be raised in this firearms inquiry that's being conducted in State Parliament. It's scheduled to go for almost 2 weeks, so it's not just a quick tick and flick exercise. And it kicked off this morning with a session on community safety. In other words, there were representatives from a number of organisations having their say. For example, the Centre for Women's Safety and Wellbeing, and also the Commissioner for Victims of Crime. Overall, they seemed relatively happy with the changes that have been made to the Firearms Act. In other words, they seemed to support most of the changes. And they were voicing their opinion that they wouldn't want to see those changes retracted. The second session this morning, though, was from various organisations with views on conservation. A couple of government departments were representative, so DBIRD and the DBCA. DBCA is the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attraction. And its representatives talked about their submission, which says, despite working with WA Police for almost a year to resolve known issues, some still remain unresolved. And the main problem DBCA has relates to the future of its Animal Control Agent Program, or its ACA program.
And what is that, Richard, the Animal Control Agent Program?
Yeah, it's where DBCA staff and registered volunteers use firearms to euthanise kangaroos on the roadside after they've been hit by cars, euthanise or put them down. Stuart Smith from the DBCA was saying in the past it's played an important role in supporting their ability to quickly respond to calls from the public. And for animal welfare reasons, speed is really important. And when you're talking out in the country, having to travel a certain amount of kilometres, it makes it harder and harder to get there quickly. But the DBCA is saying under the new laws, there were only two licence types which allow for the euthanasia of animals. One which covers department staff and another which covers shooters operating a commercial business. And the DBCA is saying neither licence type accommodates for volunteers who are helping out in their animal control agent program.
So where does that leave DBCA then?
Well, basically, they're saying they're reviewing their whole operation of that particular program, and they're saying it's doubtful that they're going to be able to absorb the costs in the current operational budgets to try to continue to carry out their animal control agent program. In other words, it sounds like they're hinting they would like an increased budget for the DBCA for that particular side of things. But this is where the inquiry got interesting, from my perspective anyway. A guy called Paul Cook fronted the inquiry this morning as well. Now, he represents Conservation Australia, which relies on volunteers to euthanise injured animals and also to shoot feral animals. Now, I found this section interesting, not just from a conservation perspective, but also for anyone on the land, because the things that were being raised in this little discussion, I think a lot of people would be able to relate to it.
We have had in a number of submissions a lot of speculation that the changes have resulted in or will result in volunteers being reluctant to participate, and in particular about euthanising injured animals at the roadside. So I'm just wondering if that's actually been evident in practice, if the number of volunteers has decreased, and if this is a similar rate of attrition to other years. And if yes, then how could we allay those people's concerns?
You're asking anyone in particular or a general question?
No, open to the panel. Right. So, I think you're all engaged within volunteers in some capacity.
Within Conservation Australia, I'm not aware of any of our members who continue to volunteer to euthanise either animals on farmland or animals by the side of the road. The concern they have is that when they read the legislation about what is required to be able to go and use a firearm, they can't see a way where they can go and do it legally. For example, if you are going to go and use a firearm on a farm, you need to have a temporary hunting permission to allow you to go and do that. When they ask, well, how do I deal with my temporary hunting permission to go and shoot an injured kangaroo on the side of the road, no one can provide them with that pathway to go and do it. So if they go and do that, they are doing that at their own personal legal risk and risking their firearms license, not just for the immediate future, but for the disallowance periods that are associated with a breach of the Firearms Act. And so they have said it's just too hard for us to do. We're not prepared to take that risk. And as far as I know, all of my members that were doing it have now withdrawn from that service.
And where are they getting their understanding of the legislation and its regulations from?
So, unfortunately, the legislation as it is written is difficult for a layman to comprehend. It has a very legalistic tone, goes against the recommendation of the Law Reform Commission to make it more readily accessible to a person to understand. And so they'll read through it themselves, they'll find something which piques their interest, and they talk about it amongst themselves, and they go, you're right, I can't see how we're going to do it. And they just walk back from it.
Okay. So they're not relying on formal communications from WAPOL or government agencies?
Getting communications from WAPOL at the moment is problematic. WAPOL have found themselves swamped with inquiries about the transition period, licences, compliance, all those sorts of things. Like when I have tried to ring WAPOL, I do it when I set aside 3 hours and I'll sit down at the computer with my phone on speaker and do a bunch of work on the computer waiting for WAPOL to answer. Quite often, the phone will just ring out and hang up on me, and you ring back and try again. To go and do that, to ask a question like that, a lot of people are dissuaded from doing so. It is not a practical proposition to say, oh, you can just ring up WAPOL and ask them. And so they just look at it and say, well, look, they haven't made it clear. They put all these obstacles in my way. I just can't be bothered doing it. I'll withdraw my services.
So do you think some clear communications would allay some of that and some of that kind of, you know, the spreading of laypersons' interpretations of legislation, you know, that a clear communication with the parameters of what people are and aren't allowed to do would allay people's concerns?
I think it needs to go beyond that. So one of the other things which is coming up inside the shooting community is that do not trust what you are told over the phone. We say that to our members all the time, both in this club and other clubs I'm with. If you get some advice from WAPOL, get it in writing. Because at some point you come along and someone says, well, what you're doing is illegal. So, but I spoke to some guy on the phone who told me it was okay. That won't stand up. You need to have it in writing. So really what it needs to be is a change to the legislation to make it explicit, as we were saying, that if you are involved in these sorts of activities, you are covered by this section of the Act, which allows you to go and do it without fear of penalty. It needs to be put in a way where an average person reading it can understand the intent and the letter of the law. It needs to be put into legislation and or regulation to make it explicit.
I'm not sure if Ralph or whether you... it's from... Ralph said that Conservation Australia was facing difficulties in fulfilling obligations under the grant from DPIRB for feral cat management because of regulations. Can you explain those difficulties, or Ralph?
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong here, Ralph, But I believe our concern is that in general, having enough of our membership available to go out and undertake conservation shooting is becoming harder under the regulations and legislation, where people are dissuaded from continuing on. And so our ability to get enough people into the field to go and meet the obligations or the commitments that we have made to various departments and even to other land managers is coming under strain. So I think before the legislation, we had a membership of 180, and that was the limit we placed upon ourselves as the most number of people that we could manage with our structures and our organisation. It does go up and down a little bit. It was sitting at 180. As soon as the legislation came in, we dropped straight down to 140, with people saying, I'm not going to renew, I'm giving up, it's all too hard for me to go and do. So it used to be 180 with a waiting list, now it's 140.
So recognising, obviously, that we are in a transition phase and implementing the legislation, and again, this is a question for anyone to answer, do you think the issues are in the legislation itself? Is that what's putting people off, or is it their experiences with the portal, their experiences with perhaps differential communications from different bodies and the kind of the administration? And, you know, so is it an issue of implementation and transition, or is it an issue of the legislation?
If I could jump in again at the risk of hogging everything. So it is a combination of all of them. So at the moment, there are a number of people who got out of participation because they couldn't see a way through the legislation and regulation to maintain their existing firearms licence. Others got out because they looked at the regulation and the requirements are placed upon them for things like increased storage and increased security, and said, it's just too expensive for me to go and do for something where I go out a bunch of times a year to volunteer my time for conservation and pest animal control. These additional thousands of dollars are just too much for me to go and bear. Some of it has been the experience with the portal, but maybe not so much. I think the portal has been really annoying and very stressful for people, but I don't believe that the experience with the portal have driven people out of the recreation. It's been more the regulation and the legislation. What we should also be worried about is not so much the immediate impact now, but also the impact going into the future. So you look at what is the pathway for someone, say, in their 20s, who says, I wouldn't mind getting into conservation shooting. What is their pathway to go and get into that? So by the regulations at the moment, you need to have a land authority to even apply for your firearms licence. You go along to a farm and say, hey, listen, I don't own any firearms. I don't do any shooting yet, but I can't get a land authority from you. The farmer says, well, I've only got 15 to give, and you haven't got any firearms, and you haven't got any hunting experience. Well, so no. So that ability to go and get that land authority, which is your first step towards getting into recreational shooting, is being blocked off. When I look through the legislation and the regulation, when I try and advise people that want to try and get into this, it's the recreation, about how they go and do it, what is their pathway to go through and do it, it's not clear to me what that pathway is and what I should go and advise them. And certainly the legislation provides no clear pathway for people entering in. Sporting shooting, there is a difference, and they go through the clubs, and there's a pathway to join the clubs as a novice and to work your way through to firearms ownership and becoming a more serious and experienced competitor. For recreational shooting or hunting, that pathway isn't there. And I think there could be a pathway there, but it would absolutely require a change to the regulation and the legislation to be able to enable that. And I can talk more.
Paul Cook, he is the membership officer with Conservation Australia, and he was speaking at this morning's session of the Firearms Act inquiry, day one of that inquiry. Richard Hudson has spent most of the morning just listening in to those proceedings of the early sessions. And that's just this morning's session, Richard. When will farmers get a chance to have their say to this inquiry?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, this goes for almost 2 weeks. So some of the farmers and other shooting representatives will get a chance next Wednesday to have their say. I might add, Paul Cook was just chatting there to Dr. Katrina Stratton, who's MLC, member of the Legislative Council, that's the committee, on the committee that is holding this Firearms Act inquiry. Some of the shooters and ag organisation representatives that are going to be chatting next Wednesday include the KPCA's Bron Christensen and also the PGA's Tony Seabrook.
Richard, thanks for going through those details and just sharing a little bit of those proceedings this morning into the Firearms Act inquiry. 19 past 12. As Richard was just saying, Tony Seabrook from the PGA is going to be one of the people presenting at that inquiry and giving his thoughts on that. He's been busy today too, just talking about regional roads with the Premier And the Premier, Roger Cook, saying the state government has invested heavily in regional roads and will continue to do so. Earlier this morning, President of the PGA, Tony Seabrook, called in to the morning show's talkback line to raise his concerns directly with the Premier about the condition of the Great Southern Highway.
Premier, I have met with the Minister for Transport and I've been pursuing this for many, many years, but the amount of money being spent in the metro area on roads is absolutely dazzling. You've got fantastic roads down there. My road, the Great Southern Highway, has a 100km speed limit on it. It's got corners that are limited to 90, one at 80. There's a continual stream of accidents, including a B-double with hail that went over last Saturday. I would like to meet with you at the Lakes and bring you for a drive on my road to Perth, which hasn't changed since my great-great-grandfather drove up it.
Sorry, Tony, I need to move on. What's your question? Yeah. More money for country roads?
More money for regional roads. Yeah, so, Tony, you'll be very pleased to hear that as a result of the great road upgrades we've made to the state highway network, $1 billion for 10,000 kilometres worth of upgrades to improve safety on that road. We are now moving to regional local government high-speed roads. That's around widening the roads, firming up the shoulders, putting more audible edging and audible centre lines. So we're now moving to the next phase of that project. We've invested significantly across regional roads and we will continue to do so. I take the point that you make, and if you're inviting me on a road trip, I'd love to join you and have a look at some of your beautiful country.
The Premier, Roger Cook, speaking on Nadia Mitsopoulos' morning show earlier today, 21 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
The latest Australian Eggs sustainability report is showing that the cost of living crisis has consumers placing equal, if not more, emphasis on the price of eggs rather than the production system. The industry group commissioned research company Voconic to survey over 5,000 people on their attitudes to eggs and the industry. Lead researcher Dr. Kieran Moffat says the survey also reveals shoppers want to trust the industry to deliver a product that they want to buy, and that trust depends on three key factors.
What we've found is that consistently over time, industry responsiveness to community concerns is a really strong driver of trust in the relationship that Australians have with the Australian egg industry. And we also see over time the rise of other factors like confidence in regulation as an important driver of trust, and also the nutritional value of eggs as part of a strong positive value proposition for the egg industry in Australia.
Well, let's see what you found out in terms of consumption, because quite a few people, more than half, are saying they're eating somewhere between 1 and 5 eggs a week. Is one egg a day about right? Is two too many when it comes to cholesterol?
Yeah, well, I guess I'm not a nutritionist, but from what I understand, I guess views around the role of eggs and what a good number of eggs to eat is has changed over time. And I know in my household we go through a 30-pack a week pretty comfortably. So I think the role of eggs has really increased, and the number of eggs eaten every day in Australia is edging over 18 million. So it's incredibly central part of the diet.
And if you look at regulation, because you did ask people about this and trust, you know, there's been a push to get the industry to shift away from caged eggs and into free range, but the supermarkets have just rolled that back. They've saying they're going to delay that because of the bird flu risk, the effect, the impact of that on supply, the risks with free range in terms of bird flu. So, you know, what are people telling you about caged eggs versus free range?
Yeah, there's a few things in that. So what we've seen over time, so remember, we've been doing this since 2018. What we've seen is that in terms of informing purchasing decisions, it used to be that the way that the eggs were produced, so whether they were free range or cage or barn laid or whatever it might be, that was the dominant issue or the dominant factor that informed what types of eggs people were buying. But over time, and I think in the context of our current challenges around cost of living, the price has become about equal with the way that the eggs were produced as a factor that informs purchasing decisions. So that's the first thing. We also see in the data really strong concern around cost of living. That's no surprise to anybody. So that's those two things are working together. And then you couple that with the nutritional value of eggs and that that doesn't differ between cage and free range, that it's no surprise that Australians are choosing based on price in a cost of living crisis to a greater degree than they perhaps have in the past.
So well, they have gone up quite a bit, haven't they? Like the caged eggs were $4.50 on average in 2020. They're nearly $6 today. But it's not the highest they've ever been either, has it? If you track them over time, they were more expensive back in that sort of 2008 period.
Well, exactly. And in terms of other sources of nutrition as well. So I think as a part of the diet, you know, our data suggests that Australians still feel this is a really affordable source of nutrition. And when you're trying to feed a family, I think it's a really good way to get some good stuff into your kids. We also see actually a changes in the attitudes of Australians towards hen welfare as part of the Australian egg industry, that there's a greater understanding of the complexity of welfare, which is just to say free-range hens are happy and caged hens are unhappy, that Australians have a more nuanced understanding of the complexity of hen welfare.
So maybe two-thirds saying the industry is acting responsibly, but there's still more than maybe half, only about half of people were saying that egg farms are regularly audited. There's maybe still this concern that actually more work should be done, you know, with people from authorities going and visiting egg farms.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting finding, and that's really strong in most years. But my sense here is that this is about ensuring that there are mechanisms that support transparency and support the adherence of egg farmers to the agreed regulatory frameworks that exist to ensure things like hen welfare, but also biosecurity and food security. And now what we can see a greater emphasis on traceability of eggs in the system. So labelling is really important to Australians. So those things around observing the way egg farms are operating, ensuring that they're doing the right thing and operating within the guide that is there for them and regulatory framework is a key mechanism for Australians to feel confident that those eggs that they are purchasing and eating or feeding to their family are produced in the right way and are delivering the nutrition as they expect.
So this study was paid for by the egg industry. What's the big takeaway for egg producers, do you reckon?
I think for egg producers, the key thing that I communicate with them is that industry responsiveness to community concern is a really strong driver of public trust in their industry and then acceptance of their activities, that the central role of eggs as a part of the Australian diet is really important, and that they're valued as egg producers. And I think often it can feel as though you're only seeing negative things about the egg industry if you're an egg farmer. But actually, one of the things I try and do in communicating these findings is actually to have confidence in the relationship. What we can see is that that has improved over time. Trust has never been higher in the egg industry, and that that they have a really strong foundation on which to continue to build that industry presence in the Australian community. So stick with it and be part of that conversation around some of the more challenging areas, like whether that's hen welfare or whether that is the transition from free range to from cage to free range, I should say, or whether that's around managing environmental challenges. So I think these are the things that I like to talk to the egg industry about.
Dr. Kieran Moffat, he's the lead researcher at Voconic, speaking to David Claughton about the latest Australian Eggs survey. It's the eighth year they've done this survey, and this time round they're really noticing, well, they have been for the last few years really, that the cost of living crisis has shoppers placing equal, if not more, emphasis on the price of eggs rather than the production system, rather than if they're caged or free range, for example. And I wonder if that rings true for you. Let me know your shopping habits, what you look for when it comes to eggs on the text 0448 92604. 29 past 12, Jonathan Hopper in the studio with the headlines. Hello.
Good afternoon, Belinda. Premier Roger Cook says if an additional hospital was built north of Perth, it would likely be at an earmarked site in Yanship. The Premier gave a strong indication this morning the government will need to consider communities to the north of Joondalup as a potential site for a new hospital. Amid the state's health crisis and calls for more hospital beds, the government has maintained any future hospital would be guided by population growth. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has joined the United States in condemning Israel's strike on Qatar as a violation of the country's sovereignty. Israel claims the strike targeted senior leaders of Hamas in Qatar. The Gulf state has been a key mediator in peace talks. And Fremantle midfielder Neil Erasmus will remain with the Dockers until the end of the 2028 season after signing a three-year deal with the club. The 21-year-old was out of contract and had attracted interest from other clubs. Thanks, Belinda.
Jonathan, thank you so much for that update. 12:30.
The Country Hour.
I found it pretty good, actually.
Yeah, that's a great question.
You never knock back rain.
The Country Hour.
You know, you should get around it.
Part of your community and your life for 80 years on ABC Radio.
Between now and the news at 1 o'clock, we'll head off to Katanning for the results of the sheep market just before the news at 1. Tracy Kilner will go through the yarding and the prices for you. And we'll also be catching up with a great southern mum who is going to share her experience from having children in country area. She's from Darkin, about 210 kilometres south of Perth. And just that experience of, you know, looking for a support group after becoming a mum and not finding much available, but then finding a really great online mothers group. And she wants to share that experience and encourage others to maybe jump on board with that sort of support. And we'll also be speaking to the president of the Australian Veterinary Association, who says it is really critical that there's more funding to support vets into the future and how they tackle the biosecurity responses that we'll probably be dealing with here in Australia with a range of pests and diseases. First, making our way to the Bureau of Meteorology, Grace Abbott is with you today. Grace, how's it looking across the Southwest Land Division this afternoon?
Yeah, hi, Belle. Look, we have a high-pressure centre, which is sitting around the southwest corner of our wonderful state, and it extends a ridge inland over southern districts and into the Northern Territory. So anti-clockwise winds around that high are continuing to deliver showers to the south coast east of around about Albany. Now, tomorrow, those light showers are going to contract to the coastal Eucla district. With this ridge overhead, clear skies overnight can lead to a pretty cool and frosty morning. So we saw that this morning. We got down to 0 to 2 degrees at Darkin, Katanning and Franklin, while parts of the eastern Great Southern District, like Lake Grace, had cloud overhead with a very different minimum temperature up at 8 degrees. Now, it is a pretty similar story tomorrow, just a tad warmer with those minimum temperatures, sitting around 1 to 3 degrees forecast for Boyart Brook through to Kellerberrin, east to Norseman and Salmon Gums, all the way to Balladonia. Therefore, some patchy frost is possible tomorrow morning, though it does look a bit less likely than this morning, with some fog also mostly in the valleys through those districts as well. Now, that frost risk is really going to ease off on Friday morning as a cold front approaches for Saturday. So what that means is that we're going to see some winds freshen from the north, and therefore they're going to increase the minimum temperatures as they drag down some warmer air from the north. Maximum temperatures are also going to increase to around 25 to 26 degrees on Friday for places like Dalwallinu, York and Meriden, ranging down to around 22 at Narangarup. So Saturday brings a pretty tricky combo of a cloud band to the western districts from around Geraldton to Bunbury for the early morning, but we've also got a cold front entering the frame in the southwest districts also in the morning. So this makes timing pretty difficult to determine with a bit of model disagreement over the reach of the prefrontal cloud band, but what we can say is that showers are going to be gusty because there's lots of strong winds aloft. So as for the rainfall, we're looking at about 5 to 15 millimetres from Gingin to Collie, roughly, or for those areas, 2 to 10 millimetres Kalbarri down to Pingerley to east of Albany, and less than 3 millimetres if you're outside of that. Lucky to get up to a millimetre at Mount Magnet and Kalgoorlie.
So we get a little bit of sunshine, don't we, on the weekend before that rain comes through.
I know. It is so hard to dry the soccer boots at the moment. So for Sunday, we are still waiting for a bit of model alignment there as well. We do have a westerly flow with another front on the way, maintaining showers to the southwest land division. So we have 5 to 15 millimetres, up to some isolated totals of 20 to 30, southwest of about Perth to Albany on Sunday. About 2 to 10 millimetres if you're a bit further inland, so northern and Wagen. But much of the southwestern half of the state outside these areas may grab a light drop on Sunday. It's pretty hard to tell. We're just waiting for a little bit more agreement in those models. And I will quickly point out while we're still in the southwest that there's no frost beyond tomorrow morning until possibly Tuesday morning next week.
Oh, that's a good note to end that part of the state on. Let's move into northern and eastern parts. Grace, how's it looking?
Yeah, so this ridge in the south has directed some southeasterly winds over much of the north, and that's pushed a trough that brought some showers and thunderstorms around the northern interior. Well, it's pushed that trough up into the North Kimberley. So anywhere south of that trough is in a pretty dry and fresh southeasterly airflow. The winds there will ease off from around about Friday as that high-pressure centre moves off into southeastern Australia. Now, those showers and thunderstorms in the northern Kimberley are only here until tomorrow afternoon, and it's looking pretty dry in the Kimberley beyond that. Now, from Saturday into Sunday, any rain in the northwest will come from a cloud band, so less than 1 millimetre on Saturday if you're sort of in the coastal Gascoyne region. Though there is 0 to 6 millimetres possible from Carnarvon through to Mount Magnet, maybe reaching inland a little bit further to the northern goldfields. Again, though, it's a bit of a watch this space as the models are not really agreeing too much on the extent of this cloud band. So keep an eye out for Sunday.
And Grace, Richard Hudson here is a huge football fan of all disciplines, and he's curious to know if you're a striker.
Oh, yeah. So soccer player, I usually play out on the right wing.
Uh-huh. Okay, does that make sense to you, Richard, right wing?
I was just assuming it'd either be a striker, yeah, some sort of, you know, relevance to the weather, being a striker, raining goals, for instance.
I'll take that to the game on Sunday. Thank you, Richard.
Grace, thank you for going through those details. Appreciate that. It is 24 to 1. Yes, Richard Hudson here, taking a look at the rainfall figures.
Yeah, nothing in the north at all, but in the east, the far east, Eucla had 3 mils, and that was about it. Then in the southwest land division, in the lower west, Wanneroo had 5 mils at the Deep Erd station, and in the southwest, Windy Harbour had a bit of a downpour with 11. Apart from that, I think the highest was 2. And then in the southern coastal region, Erinair had 12, but that was over 3 days. And then Munglin up west and the Duke recorded 3. Nowhere else got any rain at all.
Thanks, Richard. 23-1. Heading to Katanning for the results of the sheep market just before the news at 1 o'clock. First up, though, a great southern mother who found support through an online mothers group is encouraging others to join, calling it a powerful source of connection and understanding. Janelle South is a farmer from Darkin, 210 kilometres south of Perth. She says becoming a mum in a country town was an isolating experience. And when she had her first child, there was no local mothers group to turn to for support.
Having my first child in a rural area, I found that I had made friends in the community, but a lot of them were of slightly different age groups to me. And so I found it suddenly quite hard to have the limitations of having a little baby, but still socially catching up with other people that were sort of at different stages of life. I was really lucky to have one friend just down the road at the similar stage. But other than that, there really wasn't much. And I wasn't offered any mothers groups or connections once Bub had arrived. I know there has been phases where the child health nurse will organise a group of mums and sort of put them in touch with each other. But I think it was just an unlucky phase at that time. There wasn't, many other bubs born right around the same time.
What year is this?
Yeah, we got married and moved to the farm in 2012. And then, 2018, I had my first baby.
And did you know much about farming when you moved to the farm here?
Not in terms of lived experience, I guess. I didn't grow up on a farm. I had completed my 4 years of an animal science degree and spent a lot of that time in an ag-focused study once I yeah, met my husband, who's the farmer, obviously, and then had worked, yeah, in the industry for a few years before, sort of as I came back to the farm. But no, I certainly didn't grow up on a farm, but absolutely love it.
What were some of the biggest changes?
Oh, it's just the convenience things, I think, when you first get here. You know, popping to the local cafe and bumping into people you know, or just ducking down to the grocery store at the end of the day on the way home from work to, yeah, get dinner and things like that. I think you just have to be a little bit more organised and planned.
With that in mind, what are some of the difficult parts that you found challenging when you were a new mum in this area?
Yeah, I think it's mostly that. It's that socialisation and exercise sort of side of it, I guess, and the ability to do those things. We are really lucky to have a daycare in town 4 days a week, but we don't have, you know, a gym with a creche or, like I said, a mother's group wasn't available. And yeah, I looked at friends and family that had babies in the city and they were, you know, had their mother's group and they would pop down to the local cafe each morning for a walk just to get out of the house. Whereas for me, that was a 20-minute drive, you know, to the local cafe if it was open. So yeah, it became quite isolating because you couldn't just duck out and do what you wanted to do quickly. It was a bit of a process to pack up and plan around meal and nap times.
So where did you look to for support then?
I don't know. I tried my best to sort of, you know, go out and about and be in contact with other people when I could. I started listening to a podcast, or a few actually, several podcasts that I found that was kind of helpful, just to know that it wasn't just me that felt like that, that others had the same sort of story and I could relate to. And then through one of those podcasts, I was aware that there was an online mother's group. So I signed up for that, and that was really cool. Got put in touch with 9 other mums, so little groups of 10 from across Australia, but all with babies of similar sort of age. This wasn't until my second child though, so I really wish I had had that the first time around, because the second time around, I suppose you're a little bit more connected by then, and the older kids are going out and, you know, in the school environment and daycare and things like that. So it would have been more crucial the first time around, but second time, that was definitely nice to have that group connection.
Absolutely. And you said that there were women from all across Australia, so I imagine that would have been really powerful to have women in similar positions to you but different locations. Was it just motherhood that you'd speak about when you did get on the online chat?
No, it wasn't just motherhood. It's all those other things. Farming's so intertwined, the family and the work, and, you know, the wider family relations. So there was a lot of discussion on there about succession and how people had done it, and just generally the challenges of, you know, when it's harvest or whatever the relevant time was, depending. We've got a beekeeper and a dairy farmer and all sorts in our group. But, you know, when the blokes are out busy in those long hours, what are the tips and tricks to, yeah, helping keep the household run and sharing recipes that were really easy and stuff like that as well.
Did you know much about online groups like this one before you joined, that they were a thing?
No, absolutely not. I'd never heard of it. Like I said, I was jealous of those mums I knew that had mothers groups in real life, but I suppose I never actively looked, but I'd never, heard of anything until it was only because I was listening to this podcast that mentioned it, and then I went searching for it and, found this opportunity.
Do you still keep in touch with the women that you connected with?
Yeah, I do. So that would have been 4 years ago now. But yeah, we still have a chat group. It's not facilitated or organised catch-ups anymore, but we definitely still just post on there every now and then. People will share their wins or share their challenges. Yeah, when people are really struggling with something in their local town or really struggling with something within their family, it's kind of a nice safe space to speak to someone outside of your normal social network that you're seeing all the time as well, or people that know your family. It's like we were still chatting yesterday. It's so worth it just to have that group to chat with, even if you can't see them in person. And we did have Zoom calls to start with, so it kind of felt like you knew, you know, their kids, because they were crawling over them and appearing on screen and things while we were talking. So yeah, I just guess take any opportunity you can to connect.
In the next couple of weeks, Janelle, there is an opportunity coming up where mothers can connect. What's this event that is about to happen? Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, so we're really lucky to be hosting the Motherland charity in Darkin. So it's the first time they're coming across to Western Australia, which is really exciting. So Motherland is the organisation that I found these online mothers groups through. So they call it the Motherland Village. And yeah, they're coming to WA. Steph, the founder, will be hosting. Yeah, we'll have 3 amazing women who are all locals from WA that have their own parenting stories, and they'll be in a panel session.
Doug and Mum Janelle South speaking to Kate Forrester about her success joining an online mothers group. And as Janelle just mentioned, the Motherland event is coming to Darkin in a few weeks' time on the 21st of September. It's going to be held at the Town Hall. So if you're keen to head along or you want some more information, the best place to go, search online for Motherland and Darkin, and you'll find the information you need there. Motherland and Darkin, just do a search online for that and you'll get the info you need. I wonder if that's a similar experience that you had when you first became a parent, if you're in a country, rural, regional part of WA, what that experience was like. Where did you go to get support and what was it like? The text is 0448 922 604 to be part of that conversation. We've also been talking about eggs. Australian Eggs has just finished and released the results of its latest sustainability survey, basically finding out what shoppers want or think about the eggs they're buying, what they're looking for in particular. Sandy on the text says, a note to egg farmers, we buy the cheapest free-range eggs from one of the big supermarkets. What about you? Let me know, 0448 922 604. And also, right at the top of the hour today, we were talking about the Firearms Act inquiry, which got underway in Perth today. It goes for quite some time. There's a range of different people speaking about some of the issues that have come up with WA's tough new gun laws. And I wonder if you were to be part of that inquiry, to make a presentation, what would be the key points you would raise about WA's new gun laws? What are the key concerns for you? 0448 922 604. Text through. Be part of the conversation. 1:45.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
The Australian Veterinary Association wants some more funding to help vets support the nation's future biosecurity responses as the threat of pests and diseases is set to increase. Dr. Gemma Chuck is president of the AVA, and she says vets are Australia's first line of defence in the detection of animal disease outbreaks, and they play a critical role in protecting Australia's biosecurity.
I think the general public, when they think of vets, they think of cats and dogs, but what they may not be so aware of is the critical and essential role that vets play in biosecurity, food security and food safety, and also their critical role in public health. So every single Australian is actually impacted by the work that veterinarians do, and we are calling for the federal government to help build a more sustainable veterinary workforce across Australia. We are asking for HECS help forgiveness programs to attract veterinarians into regional and rural areas. We're asking for veterinary students to be included in the Commonwealth PRAC payment scheme to enable them to visit rural and regional areas during their 52 weeks of compulsory work placement during their 5-year course, which is sometimes actually 7 years, their course. And we're also asking for an established national veterinary workforce strategy to help address the current workforce shortages. So we've been experiencing a workforce shortage now for 8 years, and it doesn't look to be getting any better. And we really need some designated funding in this space to ensure that our biosecurity practices, our public health and our food security have a sustainable future.
The federal government has invested or announced more than $100 million in strengthening Australia's biosecurity, especially in the wake of avian influenza. So is any of that dedicated towards vets?
We really welcome that, and we really acknowledge the importance of that investment to strengthen our surveillance and our preparedness and our response capability. And we also really welcome the $12 million investment as part of that by the federal government, which will bolster our national response. That was announced a couple of weeks ago, and we believe that funding is being provided to states and territories to purchase that critical equipment like drones and mobile laboratories and things. However, whilst all that is really important and we think that's a fantastic initiative, we need an investment in the people. And we need a robust and available veterinary workforce to actually enable that rapid mobilisation. So the equipment is great, but we actually need investment into our people as well. And really for the HECS help forgiveness to attract veterinarians into rural areas after they graduate, that would be about $24 million annually. If we included veterinary students into the Commonwealth Prep Payment Scheme, that would be just over $12 million annually. Yes, the investment has been great for the equipment and to bolster our biosecurity, but we need investment into the people as well.
Australian Veterinary Association President Dr. Gemma Chuck speaking to Jane McNaughton and calling on the federal government for more funding to help vets support the nation's future biosecurity responses. 10 minutes to 1. The founding father of the National Livestock Identification System, John Wild, says the data it collects should not be made available to the supermarkets. Now, this follows a recent announcement from Coles that by the end of this year it would stop sourcing beef linked to deforestation, and it supported the idea of using NLIS data to validate that claim. John Wild says that would be an inappropriate use of the National Livestock Identification System.
Well, clearly there's always been people wanting to get access to the database, and that's a very sensitive issue. Now, you've got to realise why we started the database, and it was to overcome the problems we'd faced with DDT, contamination, Dieldrin, and then finally CFZ. So the database has always been there for biosecurity reasons, for food safety reasons, not for marketing reasons. And we've got to maintain the confidence along the supply chain that their data is going to be treated with a great deal of privacy and care. So any previous requests for access are always considered on their merit, but they've got to be judged against industry good rather than personal good. So it's got to be good for the industry, and it's not got to work against the interests of people along the supply chain. Data collection's quite a tricky issue, and there's always a question of who owns the data. So data always has to be handled with a great deal of respect. So it's not easy to access the information on the database, and I hope it stays like that.
Would there be any negatives to come if Coles did get its hands on that data?
Well, I think it would set a precedent, and then you'd find it very hard to refuse other people. Look, I don't know what the decision will be. As I say, all we ever collected the data for was for biosecurity reasons. And part of the compact with the supply chain, if you like, is that data will be treated with a great deal of care and respect. There are requests all the time from various research bodies. They want to know about movement of stock, et cetera, et cetera. So you can get access to the data, but it has to be treated with a, you know, so we're not going to breach privacy and we're not going to breach commercial confidence. So, you know, I don't know how this will be treated, but I'd hope it would be, you know, not allowed myself.
Obviously, the NLIS is very well supported by livestock producers. Do you think that support might diminish if an organisation like Coles was allowed access?
Well, I think so. Look, any access has to be, you know, justified. And it's not only producers. You've got processors, you've got feedlotters, you've got other people along the supply chain that supply data in good faith. You've just got to be very careful that we don't set a precedent that's going to bite us in the future. And I mean, the ACF was saying a lot of other things about, you know, there should be transparency because there's government money in there. Well, you know, that doesn't hold water. I mean, most of the database is funded by industry levies, mainly from producers, processors, feedlotters, sheep producers, etc. There has been government co-funding in R&D, 50-50, way back. And there's recently been a significant grant to update the database, which is good. So, yes, there's government money in there, but that doesn't mean to say it's got to be open to the public. I think any access has to be treated with a great deal of care.
How important has the NLIS been as a biosecurity tool?
Absolutely important. I mean, we're judged against the national standards, which require FMD susceptible species to be traced back very quickly within 24, 48 hours. You have to have all the data on where those animals have been. So that gives us a great tool in case we do get an exotic disease outbreak. But more than that, it enables us to give assurances to our customers in Japan and the US, South Korea, all those high-valued markets which are so important. We can give them an assurance that their beef is safe. We tend to forget that at one time we had a pretty poor reputation. We've had to work from that low base and earn the respect of our markets, and we've done that. So the NLI's database is absolutely crucial to maintaining our market access.
John, what's your take on what Coles has had to say in terms of linking beef production to deforestation?
Well, look, I mean, every beef producer knows that this is a bit of a furphy. I mean, it's all come about because, you know, the Amazon tropical rainforest has been destroyed by cattle. Well, all agricultural land right across the planet's been deforested. So the human race is underpinned by cleared land for agriculture. Now, clearly mistakes have been made in the past, and I think we're all aware of that. But, I mean, Australia's not engaged in massive deforestation, neither are most countries. There's no real damage being done in Victoria, for instance, by deforestation. So I think the whole thing's a furphy.
John Wild, who's the founding father of the National Livestock Identification System and a cattle producer in Western Victoria. He was speaking to Angus Verley. 1:05.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. It's Qatar reserves the right to respond to Israel's bold strike on Hamas figures within their own borders in a suddenly deepening rift in the Middle East. A Russian airstrike has killed 24 pensioners in a village in eastern Ukraine. The West Australian government concedes it's lost the battle over a new biosecurity nightmare. And Ange Postecoglou returns to the Premier League with Nottingham Forest. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
About 10,850 sheep sold at the Katanning sale yards this morning. So numbers down around 3,600 on last week. Tracy Kilner has been at the sale today, keeping an eye on things. Hello, Tracy. What was the yarding like today?
Quality was mixed with prices fluctuating throughout the sale. Processors competed with restocker buyers for store lambs, while limited numbers of heavy lamb remained firm on last week's sale, selling to a top of $310 a head. Mutton dominated the yarding, selling to a top of $250 to remain firm, while the heavy ram lambs topped at $307 and young mature rams at $209 a head. The new season lightweight lambs made $70 to $203, trade weight sold from $235 to $270, and heavyweight new season lambs sold to $290 a head. Old season lambs weighing under 16 kilos carcass weight sold from $60 to $180, heavier lambs made from $128 to $220, trade weight lambs gained selling from $200 to $286, and the heavyweight lambs sold up to $310. Ram lambs made from $100 to $307. Hoggets were in demand, with crossbreds making 160 to 194, while Merino weather hoggets ranged from 40 to 160. For the stores, medium weights sold to 185 and heavy weights returned 175 to $210 a head. Merino ewe hoggets returned from 70 to 160 for lightweights, medium and heavy weights made from 150 to 210. The store mutton gained, making from 70 to 160, while the prime medium weight ewes returned 150 to 216, and heavyweight ewes over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from $200 up to $250. Mature store wethers made from 124 to 150, medium and heavyweights returned 151 to 210, mature rams made from 40 up to $209 a head for the hoggets. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you very much for that, Tracy. Just while we're in the sale yards, the latest Meat and Livestock Australia National Sale Yard Survey has just been released, and the results reveal a significant increase in livestock transactions across Australian sale yards, with notable growth in both cattle and sheep consignments. This is an annual survey, and it really gives you a snapshot of sale yard activity for the financial year ending 30th of June 2025. And it captures data from 73 cattle and 35 sheep facilities right across the country. And there's been some impressive results here in Western Australia. If we look through this survey, Western Australia posted the largest percentage increase in sheep transactions at 60.2%, which was driven by activity at the Katanning and the Mushay markets. New South Wales led the nation with 1.82 million cattle and 9.2 million sheep transacted, marking a 22.2% and 13.4% increase respectively. And the top performing sale yards, WA gets a mention here also. The Katanning Regional Sheep Sale Yard here in WA doubled its throughput in this period, up 100.3% year on year. The Dubbo Regional Livestock Market saw a 31.9% increase in cattle throughput, and the Forbes Centre recorded a 33.5% rise in sheep transactions, but Katanning up 100.3% year on year. Right across WA on the ABC, time for the news, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.